Hey guys, thanks for listening. Just want to let you know that this episode is going to be a super special one because, like me, maybe you are curious about CERN and what CERN actually does. Well, today, this is something that I found years and years and years ago, completely forgot about, and then I found it again. So, what this isn't an interview. This is a basically, it'll lay it out, but this is the sort of like the journal of a man that committed suicide that was a physicist at CERN named Dr. Edward Mantell. Now, that name might ring a bell for some people, it might not for others, but just listen to it. It's about an hour and 20. An hour and 20 minutes long. It's like listening to an audiobook. It is fascinating, really fascinating. Just listen, like, subscribe, share it, hit us up on TikTok, hit us up on all the socials, show us some love, 5-star review, rate the show, you know, rate, review, blah 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 blah, all the good stuff. Get in contact with me on the socials, or I was going to give you the email, but then I couldn't remember it. It's always a good look. But yeah, this episode's great. Give it a listen, give it a rating, and share it. Send it to one of your mates, because that's the best way to, you know, to make the show grow. So, thank you very much. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Terrorist of fame, nuclear medicine man, smacking God with a six-figure devil's hand. Blood money's the only money there really is. Whether you bang on the block or four rooms for billions.
A note from Paranoid Times. This is for everyone that has joined our growing group. This video is the complete stories of Edward Mantell. Both the last words, and the physicist at CERN. We hope you like and share, and please comment. In just a few days book 2 will be out, and for everyone that wants to read along you can find this on Amazon. Once again keep the chain, dear listeners. The last words of Dr. Edward Mantell, a physicist at CERN. On July 13, 2016, a CERN researcher was found dead in his office from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The renowned scientist had been researching what he called a hidden code of sorts in the movement of neutrinos from the north to the south magnetic poles. His colleagues said he hadn't slept for days after he allegedly gave up on his research. He shut himself in his office, and after a couple days of not appearing in his lab or at his regular appointments, his state was discovered. He had burned all of his research in his trash bin, and his computer had been wiped of all data except one text file. Upon discovery, the document was classified but has since been leaked to the public by someone of yet unknown origin. It is assumed to be the final product of his research. This is a transcript of said document. If you're reading this, then I have failed. The LHC at CERN is capable of far more than they tell the public. Two of the most impressive experiments that has taken place at CERN, we have found a way to look at people, places, and things much like looking in a mirror. We have decoded part of the mysteries of time travel. A person can jump, as they call it, to another person or object in time. We have also found out that we can't stop something that has happened or will happen, only delay the event. Each delay pushes an event forward for 3 years. Don't ask me why 3 years, everything happens in threes. On April 29, 2016, the Large Hadron Collider was about to increase their power so high a high-energy collision inside the LHC would have created the first experimental evidence of Hawking radiation, the only radiation predicted to be emitted from a black hole's event horizon, 2 days later a supermassive black hole formed, 3 days later the Earth was gone. I saw this happen in the mirror experiments. I thought of my family, my friends, then I decided I needed to jump, do something to save them. Earlier this year a friend of the family gave me a grown offspring of Felicia the ferret, who is somewhat of a low-key celebrity in the physics community, was used to help physicists clean 300-foot pipes in particle accelerators at Fermilab, a particle physics laboratory in Illinois. Felicia. So my friends, if this worked, a headline should read: the most powerful machine on Earth was just halted by a tiny weasel. You should have another 3 years. Now I leave, but I also leave you with this. Life. Why is it so sacred? Has it been elevated to a mythical status with the onset of modern intelligence? Or, has modern intelligence caused you to come to the rational conclusion that life is but a mere commodity, one that gives nothing but advancements towards the greater good of a species that is doomed to die out as all species are? Is life without intelligence really life? Can intelligence and consciousness be separated into two distinct pools? A hive mind can be intelligent without consciousness. A conscious being can certainly lack intelligence. Which is the one that is attributed to life and is celebrated as the pinnacle of evolutionary genius? Life itself simply means to sustain biomechanical functions. Plants can wither and die. Then again, so can planets, stars, even entire galaxies. Are these cosmic entities alive? Many would say, of course not. But, if you regard the definition of healthy as being able to maintain equilibrium in a body and the definition of life as not inanimate but made up of inanimate and animate objects, then planets would certainly fit these criteria as a healthy living being. The ability to grow and maintain equilibrium is certainly a function of planets. So these people that assign the definition of life to animals and plants must maintain that intelligence or consciousness is necessary, except, plants are neither. So we must look deeper. Metabolism? Is life the ability to metabolize? To many the answer to this question is yes, though they may not know it. Enzyme-catalyzed reactions are the basis for life. Yet nowhere in these reactions does intelligence or consciousness come into play. So to preserve life, and value it to such a degree, you value these reactions. These micro-communications and effects that give objects the ability to live are prized and valued above all else. But, when one says that a person lost their life, they don't mean that they lost their ability to metabolize. They mean they lost their intelligence, their consciousness, not their chemical reactions. Why then do you value consciousness and intelligence? It is simply an evolutionary accident if some are to be believed. A mere consequence of mutations over time that slowly began evolving a brain that fires electrical impulses to categorize and understand the world around it. You were meant to see a tree and know it was a tree. You were meant to see food and know it was food. You were never meant to ask why trees exist or whether or not food was ethical to eat. And yet here you stand. You are humanity, the pinnacle of achievement, intelligence, and consciousness. However, these three ideas still confound you. You have defined life. You have categorized the world you know, and you know more about it each day, from the cosmic scale to the micro. You know what threatens life. The body is weak. Metabolic reactions can only be maintained under strict equilibrium. And in your paranoia to protect the consciousness and intelligence that you assume arose from these reactions, you try oh so very hard to protect the reactions that allow you to keep them rooted to your fragile form. But your paranoia is also destroying you. You have created medicine and sciences that go beyond what you were ever supposed to achieve. And in return the world around you changes. We return once again to equilibrium. When you created medicine that became progressively more effective at killing so-called foreign bodies, the foreign bodies became progressively more effective at resisting your attempts and at killing you. This makes you afraid. Very afraid. Because now, you are back to the unknown. Your only response is to ask more questions, figure out why this is happening. You know you can fight back, you just need to know how. So many questions. You just never asked the right one, that one question that could have saved you. Are we supposed to know? It's far too late now. You know too much. You have evolved into a resistant strain of illness to me, much like your own devastating superbugs. You have found a way to survive and thrive, evolve, through everything I have thrown at you. Your unintended consciousness and intelligence proved to be more of a threat than I could have possibly comprehended. I will give you some answers, however. You value consciousness and intelligence in people. You learn to love, to reproduce based on this. It is important to you because without it your species would wither and die. It is simply an evolution that was meant to continue the colony by bypassing natural selection prematurely. If you can gauge good qualities before reproduction by the introduction of consciousness and intelligence, it eliminates the need for trial and error. But it has gotten out of control. Natural selection is the name you gave to the process by which I have maintained equilibrium for so long. You have upset my equilibrium. But I do have medicine much stronger than natural selection now. It's only a matter of time before it starts working. But, before that, here is one final answer. You never penetrated my core. If only you had. Then you would have known that yes, planets metabolize too. Stay paranoid, my friends. I'm a physicist at CERN. We've done something we shouldn't have. Please be advised of the following. 1. I am breaking international laws regarding privacy and secrecy by publishing this information. 2. I am not going to disclose my location, since I know that any attempt to prove what I've seen or what I've been part of will result in my immediate and thorough extermination. My name is Dr. Edward Mantell, and I was, technically still am, a physicist at CERN, located in Geneva, Switzerland. I specialize in particle and subatomic research, focusing on quark interactions. In other words, I study very, very small particles and how they interact with one another at very high speeds. Until Thursday, January 15, 2014, I was a normal scientist living and working on the CERN campus. Most of the scientists who are involved in the branch of research that I am live on campus at the facility in Geneva and venture out only for social activities and the occasional visit home. Most of you who have heard of CERN will have heard of the LHC, Large Hadron Collider, the largest scientific instrument which exceeds 20 miles in diameter and travels under the sovereign territory of two countries, Switzerland, France. The public has been told that it was constructed at a cost of tens of billions of euros for the purpose of studying the birth of the universe, and the collisions that take place within the collider allow us a quick glimpse at certain phenomena that can only be witnessed when particles hit one another at incredibly high rates. This is not what the machine was designed for, nor is it what the machine has been used for since its inception. CERN's main purpose for building the collider was to, well, it was to open a doorway. Allow me to explain. The doorway idea came into fruition in the 1960s. After years and years of attempting to hide UFO phenomenon, including large-scale and very public interactions such as the Roswell incident, and the Battle for Los Angeles incident well before that, the governments of the United States, Great Britain, and France decided to throw their weight behind the understanding of what precisely these objects were. The ideas flew far and wide. Were UFOs from another planet? Were they from another time? Or were they simply mass hysteria and mass delusion fueled by the overactive imagination of a public who were shit scared of communists and their technology? No, they were none of those. Our universe is but one page in a large book. Think of a closed book sitting on a table. You see each page stacked on top of one another, bound by the spine and sandwiched between the two covers. Our universe is but one page in a vast and all-encompassing book. And our page is certainly not the only one with rich, in-depth thought and writing committed to it. Every page in the book represents a different dimension, each with its own unique writing, own unique story, own unique way of isolating itself from the other pages. No page was to interact with the other, just as no ink bleeds from one page to another in a standard book. Each page, a universe unto itself. Within a few short years of mathematical research and fleets of scientists working under threat of extermination should they share their research, the book idea was finally cemented. Though many disagreed, the mathematics were there to support the book idea, and the mathematics also showed us that it was impossible for one page to interact with another. That was, until the 1980s. During the 1980s, billions of dollars of research was funneled into the idea that if we used enough energy, if we used enough force, concentrated into a small area, the size of a pinprick, we could theoretically tear our page and get a glimpse of the page next to ours. We could open a door from their universe to ours. When the family, the code name for the group of scientists that functioned as the head of each of their departments at CERN, were shown the initial presentation in March of 1981, many of them expressed grave concern about the ramifications of opening such a doorway. But in the beautiful name of science, the family decided to share these ideas with the governments who constantly funded their research. At a meeting held in Luxembourg, the heads of state of the newly forming European Union, along with the United States and China, were shown plans for the construction of a colossal machine that would enable the opening of a doorway that could be closed at our discretion. The door would be opened, and the energy levels would be measured to prove that CERN had accomplished its task, and the door would be closed. Open. Shut. Simple as that. The government leaders threw endless funding at the family and the rest of CERN in the hopes of understanding what kind of power lay in another universe. Think of the possible endless source of energy, faster than light travel, weaponry that could obliterate enemies using laser. The possibilities for power were truly staggering. So, the public was fed one narrative, understanding the universe, and the family and governments knew the truth. Most of the scientists at CERN were kept completely in the dark. After all, the collider would perform its function as normal and collide particles for eager funding hunters to capitalize on. But the far more nefarious purpose would only be tested in the presence of the family and a few select scientists. I am the member of the family for my division. Obviously, the original family have all retired or died out, but there is a new, younger, more eager to prove themselves group now at the helm, and the consequences of this were and are dire. So, with that established, allow me to explain what happened last Thursday. It was an ordinary day with the LHC scheduled to commit two collisions, one at 9 a.m. and the other at 6:30 p.m. Both went off magnificently and the experiments were deemed a success. We witnessed two full collisions and the general group of researchers were very happy with their work. Around 7 p.m., most of the team had filtered out of the observation room, and the machine had been put into its usual standby mode. As the room emptied, the ID clip that I had on my waist, which had a built-in display and vibrator, started to go off. I looked down at the display and it said in very faint green writing "living room." I knew right away what they were going to attempt. I looked up from the badge and caught the eye of Dr. Celine Diacord, another member of the family and the head of plasma physics. She too had just looked up from her ID badge. We both understood and left. Living room was a large room under the main facility located in A section. The room wasn't special in any way and appeared completely normal. This was key to hiding our true intentions. If we met in a secret underground bunker instead of the regular basement, we'd arouse suspicion every time we were going to run an experiment. As Celine and I made our way from the collider to section A, the cold Swiss air hit my face and burned as we booked it across the campus. The night was exceptionally clear, and this factor further bolstered my suspicion. They always liked doing these experiments on clear nights. We entered section A and made our way to the main building. The doors opened up as we approached and we made our way to the elevators across the wide expanse of a lobby with the vaulted ceilings. The RFID signal given off by our name badges caused the elevator doors to open before we had even pressed the button. As we stepped in, the doors shut and the elevator began to move. "I'll never get used to that," Celine said, referring to the degree of automation that the buildings displayed. We had been scheduled for a meeting in the living room, and the building knew, so all strategic lights were on, and elevators were reading where we needed to go. The miracle of networking. We exited the lift and made our way to the regular boardroom. The door was shut and assembled inside was the family. At the head of the table was Father, a young, rather ambitious physicist named Sandra O'Reilly. Designated, Father, since she was in charge of giving orders to the family with respect to our clandestine experiments. The mood in the living room was never tense, but rather one of controlled excitement. The family had been attempting these tests once every 6 months for the past 10 years without much success. We had gone through several fathers, from the great Dr. Bert Ramberg to the lesser known and constantly drunk Dr. Yao, each had failed to achieve what the original family had planned. Billions were spent, but no door had yet been opened. "Tonight, we try 40 tera electron volts," Father announced. Her announcement brought an immediate and total silence to the room. Family members looked from one to the other, some with feigned excitement, others with revered concern, all with a general sense of disbelief. "The last four trials were between 10-20 TeV, we've never tried anything that high. We don't know if the machine can handle a test of that magnitude," protested Dr. Akava, head of mathematical physics and chief of the department that should be certifying whether or not 40 TeV was even a healthy thing to do. "We have reviewed the possible outcomes, and even though we will have to pull twice the amount of energy out of the grid, the Swiss government have been advised and are cooperating," Father quickly retorted. Her sweet, controlled tone actually did help the situation. I looked over and Celine had been frantically writing down some calculations on a piece of paper. After a few seconds she shot up from her seat. "Father, even if we try to reach 40 TeV, the math doesn't support that this is possible. We can't just throw the collider to the highest setting and hope for the best. Are there any other objections that you would like noted before we begin the experiment?" Father asked, completely ignoring Celine's desperate pleas. Father surveyed the room and could see that she wasn't going to be met with other objections. After all, what was the point? They were going to go unheeded. "Excellent, then we shall proceed, meet in the control room at 2200 hours, Father announced as the family got up from the table and left the living room. No one said a word. We left in complete silence, made our way into the lift, and exited the building into the cold Swiss night. If the machine couldn't handle the electron voltage, it could become structurally unstable and break apart, but being buried underground prevented this from being a catastrophe. There wouldn't be loss of life, but the LHC would be rendered useless and billions of dollars worth of funding would be destroyed. On the other hand, if the experiment was successful and the door opened, could we close something functioning on 40 TeV? Our math had supported 10 TeV, 20 TeV, fuck even 30 TeV, but no one had dared go above that. However, this is where our role as scientist ended and our regrettable role of secret experimenter began. All we could do was say yes. At 2200 hours, with the family assembled in the control room, and the handful of select CERN employees who understood the true nature of the experiment milling around, we commenced our grand try. "Begin," was the only order that Father issued. The family members at the control entered the required programming to begin the collider, and so our fateful experiment began. "Release the first particle sample," came the command. A few seconds later the sound of gas entering the collider could be heard. The gas started its 20-plus mile journey around the collider, gaining more and more speed. "Release the second particle sample," another sound of whooshing gas entering the tube and traveling into the opposite direction as the first. Both gaining speed, traveling faster and faster, approaching the speed of light. Like two runners, running around a circular track in opposite directions, not touching one another. "Father, we are approaching 30 TeV," one of the commanders warned. "Excellent, increase the energy to 35 TeV within the next 3 minutes," Father's commands once again brought grave concern. If anything was going to happen, it was going to happen now. "Increasing to 35 TeV," came the announcement over the intercom system. We all continued to look at one another, the concern growing graver and graver. "Achieving 38 TeV," another announcement. But nothing, no explosion, no catastrophic failure, nothing. In theory 40 was possible, but never advisable. However, at 38, no specific structural damage signs were noted, nothing. 40 TeV achieved. We looked at one another in astonishment. We had achieved what we thought was impossible, 40 TeV of energy was pushing the particles through the collider and we were sustaining it. As the two particle clouds whizzed past each other, our first indication that something different was going to happen started to occur. There was a sudden spike in the temperature of the room. We could feel that it had gotten warmer, and the first reaction was one of panic. "Shut the machine down!" came the first exclamation from a family member. "The machine is heating up, explosion could be imminent," she continued. "Wait!" exclaimed father, her eyes glowing with the reflection of the computer screen in front of her. "Look at the core temperature readout, they haven't changed, they're perfectly normal." We each looked at the closest computer screen we could find, all of them showing that everything was going well, except for the fact that the thermostat in the room now read 35 degrees Celsius, when we started out at a pleasant 20. "Could this be it? Commence the collision sequence." Father barked the order into the microphone near her control console. "Collision in 4, 3, 2, the methodical voice announced over the intercom. When an ethereal blinding light consumed the room, I had never experienced anything like this before. The temperature dropped back down to 20 degrees, and the light was overpowering us. We couldn't see our own hands in front of our faces. Suddenly there was a blood-curdling scream, like someone being horribly beaten, followed by complete and total silence and then darkness. "Is everyone okay?" Celine was shouting from her side of the room. "I'm fine," I called back. "Sound off." "Mantil, code, FAM0113 Diacord, code, FAM0115 Chung, code, FAM0114 The family members present started to scream out their names and code designation as our eyes adjusted to the total darkness that had encompassed the room. With the sound of a bang, the emergency red lighting bathed the room in a lambent glow. We could make out shadows, but no distinguishing features. By this time, approximately 2 minutes after our encounter with the white light, we still had not heard father sound off. "Where is father?" Dr. Chung called out. We all turned to the seat that father sat in, and could see a lump on the chair, but no sign of her. I entered the panel code to open the emergency exit and made my way through the escape corridor to the lighting box at the end of the hall. I turned the breaker and the normal lighting filled the control room again. Panic struck for father's well-being, I turned and ran back into the control room. All of my fellow scientists were in complete and total awe. Nothing in the room was out of place, and the temperature had returned to normal, however sitting in father's chair was a pile of her effects. Celine ran up to the chair father once filled and looked down with a gasp. "She's gone. All of her things are here, her jewelry, her clothes, her tamp, everything." Where father sat now rested her physical possessions. She had vanished into thin air. Seal. They. Room. Over the next 10 minutes, a series of both helpful and painfully obvious commands erupted from Dr. Chung. He was the senior scientist in the room and was almost a father figure not only to myself but to many of my fellow physicists. Headcounts were conducted amongst the 22 scientists outside of the family, who were recruited to be part of the experiment. Luckily, father's disappearance seemed to be an independent occurrence. The fact that the main control room was filled with senior scientists helped us handle the situation so much better. Methodical training and a fear of contamination of both material and electronic information was the most important concern at that time. We hurried to commence the network backup procedures that we were trained to undertake in the event of failure. The remains of father's effects were removed, with a ruler acting as a pair of tongs, and carefully stored in 3 UPS bags, the only sealable thing we could find. The family members worked in silence for a few minutes, the shouting from Dr. Chung having died down. The junior scientists milled around on the lower level, having been advised not to leave the facility. A general look of concern had started to make its way across their faces. They could feel from the tension in the announcements that something very wrong had happened, but had no idea of the degree of damage. "Your mother, so you're now in charge, Chung," announced Dr. Nevgathani, the Indian scientist, whose unassuming grandma-esque shape betrayed her sharp tongue and short tolerance for bullshit. You shouldn't jump to conclusion, Nevga. Arthur can't take charge until we're sure that father isn't here. Celine snapped at Nevga. Tensions were running high and we were beginning to fray. Strong leadership was needed and Arthur Chung was the man. He had been designated by father to take control of all security-related matters pertaining to the family 2 weeks prior to the incident. Arthur was number two, Arthur was mother. She's right, Sandra's not here, and she could very well be in danger. For the time being, I'll take control and attempt to coordinate what we should do. Our first decision has to be who to alert. I understand that the protocol calls for letting the Ministry of Defense know, but which other Swiss officials are on the list? You can't be serious. We can't tell a single soul about this. I couldn't keep quiet any longer, I shot up from the chair that I had been lounging in while the family politics played out. We couldn't tell anyone. There were very good reasons for this. Firstly, we've known from the beginning that if we were ever successful, we would be under heavy police surveillance and military scrutiny. Our lives would never be the same, but we would make the sacrifice, all in the name of science. But what now? What will they do to us now? We were part of the experience. The light immersed all of us. If they can't find father, they're going to go after their next best samples. We'll be studied, tested, and tested again. Who the fuck knows? Maybe vivisection. Who knows? If we were just successful, we opened a door and didn't know how to handle it, and now one of our own has vanished. We cannot tell. I was screaming by the end of my tirade, my blood boiling with a sense of injustice. We could have just made the best discovery in science, but the reward would be torture or who the fuck knows what else. Calm down, we cannot jump to conclusions. Mother's soothing tones were one of the major reasons why he was designated to take charge if things fell apart. Edward is right, but we have to ensure that this is dealt with only amongst ourselves. We'll dismiss the assistants, fewer bodies, fewer eyes and ears. Mother kept the calm. Father would have loved the fact that we were being clandestine about the whole matter. She never followed protocol. The juniors were assembled and advised that there was an excess bleed of energy through one of the circuit breakers and it exploded. The bright light was the ensuing fireball, which was a result of the explosion. Fire services have been notified. Everything was calm. Okay, what do we know? Asked Mother, who had ascended the stairs to the control room on the second level after dismissing the assistants. The remaining members of the family had been instructed to continue searching, just as they had immediately after the lights came back on, just like they had after turning control over to Mother. And quite like before, our searching was fruitless. The doors of the control room were locked during the experiment and there was no way in nor any way out. We were sealed in there. Even if Father had managed to cross the room from her control console without touching any of us, and had managed to enter in the correct 9-digit code to unlock the door to leave the room, all while the entire room was being filled with blinding light, she sure as hell wouldn't have had time to strip. She's not here, we've searched all the possible rooms, and nothing. She's vanished, we have no alternate explanation. Celine concluded. She had quickly realized that the likelihood of father still being present was next to none. Were we successful? Has anyone reviewed the data? Nevga croaked from her position in the corner. She was staring directly at me while asking, as if I had any idea what the data stated. The computers are still backing up the experimental information, we can review in about 3 minutes. Have we tried to access the CCTV feed? I responded. The CCTV could hold some clue to clarifying what we had experienced. Try and access the loop, Celine. I called out to her as she was hunched over the first console that had finished backing up. I'm on it, she responded. After a few short moments, a sound of contentment emitted from Celine. Not quite a squeak, not really a scream, and we all turned to look at her. I've got it. We rushed over to the display and crouched around. Hopefully the security feed could clarify all of this. Nothing but white light. The first few minutes of the video showed father and the rest of us at the beginning of the experiment, and then the camera whites out at a certain point due to the blinding light that had filled the room. The image adjusts and it's us in the dark panicking about the disappearance father. Utterly useless, a deflated Celine admitted what the rest of us were too afraid to say. We were left with no recorded evidence of what could have been the singular most important moment in recent science. Mother's computer had finished its backup cycle and he began accessing the information harvested during the collider run. Everything seems normal, nothing is out. He stopped midway through his sentence. We did it. We fucking did it. This was the first time that I had ever heard Mother swear, and it would have naturally unsettled me if he hadn't just announced that we had changed the world. What? What does it say? I belted out from across the room. I had to know. We had to know. 40.2 TeV maxed out, with 0.9992 C, speed, achieved, magnetic resonance and field distortion registers noticeable. Massive localized radiation spikes. Collapse. Mother stared at the screen, silence and disbelief filled the room. In layman's terms, we had concentrated the amount of energy required to tear our page. We saw a few letters on the other page, but the door slammed shut too soon to make any reading possible. But it had been done. So what happens now? I asked. Not knowing how to proceed. Our main priority right now remains Sandra and her location. We've established that the experiment was a success and her disappearance occurred at the same time. We cannot assume that they are related, but the chances are high that they are. Mother announced in his soothing tone. We have to replicate. Nevga's voice broke the calm created by Mother. Our agreement with the Geneva power grid expires at 2 o'clock, which is less than 2 hours away. We can rerun the experiment, and then see what the outcome is. We know we can open the door, maybe Sandra will come back. Celine dashed across the room and confronted Nevga, are you insane? We can't replicate the experiment. We should have alerted the authorities over an hour ago when this first happened, now we look like we're conspiring to cause more damage. The chance of Sandra falling, naked, out of the sky are just as likely as one of us vanishing. You may be 400 years old, but I am not ready to endanger myself. I'm still young. Mother interjected, quiet. Our window is closing, we have limited options. The radiation and air quality sensors in the room did not register any excessive disturbances that would be harmful to us, and we have enough of a skeleton crew amongst the eight of us to run the collider. I will not be a part of this. Celine protested, I refuse to compromise my safety again in the blind hope that we can somehow call Sandra back into the room. This is madness. You can excuse yourself if you want, but you may not leave the building. If you're not going to contribute, stay out of the way. Mother was curt with his response, and very rarely did he take such a terse tone. Celine stormed out of the room and made her way down the access stairs towards area the assistants once filled. She opened the access door and entered the observation area. Edward, prime the collider, Nevga, take the second console, Jim, Mother stationed the remaining members of the family to independent tasks once executed by a team of 3 to 5 scientists. They were the top of their fields, but this would prove a difficult task. With my hands on the release valve, I heard Mother give the prime for collision, order which brought the massive machine to life. It would be approximately 22 minutes before enough power to attempt the collisions had been displaced from the grid into CERN's reserves. We worked like a perfectly oiled machine, years of study and practice had brought the family to this point. With the particle clouds released and running against one another around the track, the collider was ready to attempt its newest collision. Commence the collision sequence. Mother's order was clear, crisp, and concise. I entered the required programming and waiting. Collision in 4, 3, 2. Again the white light. The thick, dense, clean, all-consuming, white light filled the control room. I could see it creep up on me, no sense of direction available after it hit, nothing visible except for the pure bright spot that it emanated from. This time there was no scream, but more of a loud thud. The power surge caused the safety shut off to trip again, and just as before we found ourselves in the dark room. Chung, code, FAM 0114. Thani, code FAM 0080. Mantil, code, FAM 0010. The remaining family members sounded off, and waited the necessary 30 seconds before the red emergency lighting would activate. Had it worked, what was the thud? Was it Sandra, and was she dead? The red lighting enabled. Lying in the center of the room, slightly bruised but overall appearing normal and completely naked, lay Father. We scrambled over one another to reach her. Stop! Yelled Mother. He had gone down the same corridor. I had to hit the lighting reset button. The regular lighting turned on, and we could see Sandra clearly. She was breathing, but we knew what we had to do. Mother was right, no touching. Is she breathing? Mother asked. Yes, I can see her abdomen moving up and down, Nevga responded. She had crouched next to Father and made no attempt to hide her concern. Even though she was tough, Sandra was a member of the team, and deserved her best effort. Mother threw a pair of gloves towards Nevga. Check her pulse. He ordered. Nevga obliged and began measuring her pulse. In the meantime, a family member had brought over a spare lab coat so that Father could have some dignity, even if she looked worse for wear. At this point, Celine re-entered the control room and remained strangely quiet, even in the midst of all the excitement. Nevga, content with Father's pulse, began shaking her and calling her to get up. Sandra! Sandra! Are you there? Can you wake up? Sandra began to stir. We all took a very obvious and very needed step back. We were so relieved to have Sandra back that we hadn't thought of the true question at hand: where had she gone to begin with? Sandra, it's Nevga, can you hear me? Father, can you hear me? Nevga continued to yell. Slowly, like a deer coming out of a long hibernation, Sandra began blinking her eyes. She made no attempt to sit up, but did shield her eyes from the lighting in the room. Envy. Nevga, can you hear me? Sandra asked weakly. Father. Welcome back. Nevga's face lit up as she threw her arms around Sandra. The din in the room was cleaved by the sound of the cell phone in Mother's coat pocket ringing. Hello? Yes, okay, how many? Thank you, Hugo. Mother hung up the phone and turned towards Celine, eyes locked, brow furrowed. How could you? Are you that stupid that you think they're going to let you run away while they come for the rest of us? Mother asked, his words dripping with the venom that they so richly deserved. What's going on? I asked, look at Celine but directing my question towards Mother. That was Hugo from the security division. He's advised me that Celine contacted the Swiss authorities 45 minutes ago. Their men have just crossed the security perimeter. Apparently we're currently wanted. Mother coolly explained. All eyes turned away from Sandra and towards Celine. How could you do that? You've ruined us, was the only phrase that I could think of screaming at her. We have to get out of here. Help Father up, follow me. Mother ordered and dashed into the corridor adjacent to the control room. He ran towards the control panel at the end of hall and typed in the 9-digit access code required to open the door. It wouldn't budge. He turned and looked at the rest of the family who had ran behind him, including Celine. We have to find an alternate way out. They've locked us in, Mother explained, his cool beginning to wear thin. We have to start the override procedure immediately if we have any chance of getting out of here. Nevga used the, Mother's instructions faded as I made my way back into the control room. Panic was beginning to grip me as the possibility of used as a guinea pig began to crowd out my more rational thoughts. Suddenly a faint alarm began to sound and the following announcement came over the intercom. This is Commander Eric Einmenk of the Swiss Federal Protective Services. We are entering your facility. Do not make any sudden movements. You are under surveillance. You are being detained. The booming voice kept repeating instructions to remain still. Nevga had set herself at one of the terminals and was frantically trying to override the lockdown procedure that security had initiated. "I can't work quickly enough," she said, looking up at me with real worries in her eyes. "This is my fault. I shouldn't have pushed for a rerun." The sound of the alarm became progressively louder. Celine ran back into the room, followed by the remaining members of the family who had stayed in the corridor. "Fuck it," she exclaimed, and jumped onto the nearest terminal. She began viciously hammering away the keyboard, entering command after command. Suddenly the collider sprang to life with the loudest sound I had ever heard. It was a combination of a foghorn and explosion. I looked down from the control room just as the team of heavily armed security officers burst into the collider room. "I'm sorry," Celine said. She looked up at me and entered one final line of code. Another explosion. The room filled with the same white light. "For fuck's sake, Edward, run faster," Celine screamed at me with all her might as she kept the lead position. We ran down the corridor that she was looking into prior to our friends paying us a visit. "I can't, I'm trying." I was panting heavily, and failing to keep up, but the thought of being gunned down by heavily armed Swiss militia imbued me with enough fear to haul my ex-smoker's ass up the third staircase we had found ourselves in since we commenced our escape, round two. Celine finally came to a sudden stop. She had found where we were supposedly headed and she waited for me to catch up. As I ran up behind her, I could see that she was starting to cry. "Edward, regardless of what happens to us, you have to promise me that you're going to try and make it back to the collider room." She turned slowly, revealing her perfectly beautiful face. Her eyes had always captivated me, and even in this darkened hallway, I could still make out their astral quality. Celine's beauty betrayed how absurdly intelligent she was. Far and away the most intelligent member of the team, and definitely in line to become father. It wasn't a surprise to me that she would have been chosen by mother and father to conduct the first clandestine experiment. Magna cum laude from MIT with a Ph.D. in particle physics, by the time she was 24. Intelligence didn't describe Celine's mind, she was one with the science. "Why won't they be waiting for us to go back there?" I asked with great suspicion. Was she trying to set me up? Nothing that she had told me over the past few minutes had been known to me. She had slammed me with a series of revelations that I couldn't decide whether or not to trust her. "Just trust me, Edward," she snapped back at me, her patience wearing thin, and her worry hitting an all-time high. "Regardless of what happens, promise me you'll go back there." "I promise," I weakly responded. As the words left my mouth, the sound of heavy footsteps started to emanate from the stairwell we had just left. "Run, Celine," I ordered, and she complied. My legs seemed to find new energy, boosted by the sound of our potential killers encroaching on us. I sprinted with such grace that Usain Bolt would have asked me for tips about form and foot placement. Celine quickly overtook me, so much for the Bolt being jealous. We found ourselves running down what seemed like an impossibly long corridor. A door was visible at the end. As we ran towards the door and threw ourselves out, we found ourselves running through the snow. We had left Section A and were headed to K. The door had let us out behind the building and we could hear the faint sound of the soldiers who had been eagerly looking for us. We continued running and as always I followed Celine. "Follow me, we have to find Hugo." Hugo was the security guard that had alerted mother on the phone that Celine had contacted the authorities. He was the last person who I wanted to see right now. I stopped running and yelled at Celine, "Why the fuck would you want to see him?" She stopped and turned towards me. "Because I never made the call to the authorities, Edward." She too had stopped running. As we stood in the cold, night air, I found my mind swimming with disbelief. "What do you mean you never made the call?" I asked her. "I'll explain, let's just get out of sight and into the guard area. Hopefully Hugo believes me," Celine explained. "And what happens if he doesn't?" I extended my hand and reached for hers. "Celine, we could be running directly into the maw of hell. If they capture us, they will experiment on us, they will kill us. There is no doubting that. The grave tone in my voice communicated both my fear and concern to Celine. Edward, we're running from the Swiss army. Let the absurdity of that sentence sink in on you, and then tell me if you know of any other potential friends who could help us out, Celine calmly responded. She was right, we were completely alone, and we had to turn to anyone who could potentially help us. Celine and I held hands and continued to run towards the security area where the guards were typically stationed. As we rounded the corner, we could see that there were three members of the Swiss forces which had come to get us, talking to two of the guards who were on duty. One of the guards was a tall, rather handsome man with sharp Germanic features. The other was Hugo. We have to get his attention without attracting the others, whispered Celine, and we have to do it now, before our gun-toting friends start looking over here. I was plumb out of ideas, but knew that Celine would have a trick or two up her sleeve. I'm going to whistle. She turned and looked at me as she continued to explain the plan. We were both hugging the wall which offered us some shelter and protection. Whistle. What the fuck, that'll get their attention for sure. I exclaimed, realizing that getting their attention probably meant being gunned down or tossed and subdued at best. What had my life become? Being tossed was the best thing I could hope for. Hugo and I dated for a few weeks, we didn't click, but we watched Close Encounters of the Third Kind on our first date. I'm going to whistle the tone, and hopefully he gets the hint. She explained. That's the great idea. Won't they realize that someone's clearly trying to get attention if we do that? I exclaimed at her, my voice never rising about a barely audible whisper. You have any great ideas? She snapped back at me. I could see that she was running out of options and this was a last-ditch attempt. Okay, here goes, she said. She turned the corner of the wall we were hiding behind and whistled this tone. As soon as she had finished, she whipped around the wall and threw herself to the ground next to me. We both crouched down, and kept an eye on the guard hut. What was that? One of the Swiss soldiers barked, was that whistling? He had turned towards Hugo at this point, and clearly demanded answers. The idea must have been communicated to Hugo since from our vantage point we could see him, the other guard and the Swiss soldiers having a heated debate. After a few seconds of arguing, we could see the other guard and the soldiers leave the guard hut. Celine squeezed my hand without taking her eyes off of our would-be killers. Come on Hugo, come on, she whispered. It was minus 10 but her palms were still sweating, and so were mine. Come on, come on. The other guard led the soldiers in the direction opposite to where we were hiding. Fuck yes. Celine quietly celebrated our seeming victory. Now all we needed was Hugo to head in our direction. What is he doing? She asked, as her and I both saw Hugo pick up the phone and make a call. A few seconds later he hung up and began to walk in our direction. He now started to whistle the tone, and Celine whistled back. He rounded the corner and found her and I in the snow, without our jackets, both looking worse for wear. What are you doing? Come with me to the guard hut, you can warm up there. We had no place to run, and were rapidly exhausting all of our ideas for escape. We now solely relied on the kindness of a man that Celine felt unfit to date. I could feel my hope shrinking. I realized that it wasn't you that called the authorities after I made the call to Father, Hugo said as he handed Celine the lid of his thermos, the makeshift cup filled with what smelled like chamomile tea, and a shit ton of whiskey. What? How could you know that? Celine asked as she took a wincing sip from the lid and handed it in my direction. You would never disclose that information to anyone. You would never call me and alert me about a classified experiment. That's not like you. I know stuff didn't work out between the two of us, but you have to give me more credit than that. I got to know the kind of person you were. Yeah, it's not very much, but you're just so kind, I could never see you betraying your ethics like that. He was blushing as he finished explaining his line of reasoning. Celine threw her arms around Hugo and kissed him on the cheek. Thank you, Hugo. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I hadn't seen her this happy for a while, and even I wanted to kiss Hugo at that point. He would potentially be our ticket out of here. Who did you call? Celine asked him, realizing that we needed to address who knew we were here. Who did you call, Hugo? I called my sister, I told her to come to the facility. He explained. It was about 5 a.m. at this point, and Hugo's sister lived in Geneva, about 20 minutes drive away from CERN. If anyone can help you escape, she can. I'll get you to her car and the guards will let you out the main entrance. Hugo must have definitely cared for Celine if he was willing to risk his sister's safety to make sure we were okay. If they catch you, it's over. I heard them explaining that they needed to apprehend you at all costs, he continued. We have to get back to the collider, Celine interrupted. Hugo's face drained of color. He realized that her ask was almost completely improbable and would put him at even greater risk. Why the fuck would you want to? That place is swarming with military men, you wouldn't stand a chance. Hugo lost his cool and yelled at her, I have already made arrangements for you to leave. He locked eyes with Celine as he said this. Get us back there, Hugo, or at least tell me how to, I'm not leaving CERN. Celine retorted, her face frozen in a rictus of intent. No way, I'm not going with you, Hugo shot back frustratedly. Then tell us how to get there, Celine calmly placed her hand on his and looked him directly in the face. After a few seconds of pause, Hugo released a heavy sigh, if you take this access card, you can use the underground access tunnel to get you back into the building and then use the escape ladder to climb up into the collider room. It was built in so that anyone could escape if the collider became unstable. I doubt they ever thought that someone would want to break in. Hugo finished as he handed Celine the access card. Whose is it? She asked, looking down at the tattered card with the cracked screen. It was Mother's, he said, looking at the floor. What do you mean was? What's happened to Mother? Celine asked as her voice broke. We both suspected the worst, but did not want to hear the outcome. Celine, Edward, run. They'll be back soon, look here. Hugo gestured to the display panel that stood behind him. We could see the faint tracker symbol of the guard that had escorted the soldiers heading back to the guard hut. You have to go now, he ordered as he pressed the card into Celine's hand. Thank you, I never saw you, I stole this. We never met tonight, Celine said in an attempt to allay Hugo's fears. We ran out of the guard hut, and back towards Section A. As we entered the side of the building that we had just left, Celine picked up her pace and began running in the direction of the access tunnel that Hugo had described. Here we go again. As I followed her through the maze of corridors, tunnels and hallways, I couldn't help but be mesmerized by the fact that no one had stumbled onto us. Not a single person had seen us over the past hour as we ran through the most important scientific facility in all of Europe. The first panel proved to be easy enough to open. One swipe of the access card and the door swung open with the greatest of ease. Poor Mother, what had they done to him? What had they done to Father? I couldn't see Nevga giving up without a fight. And the rest of the family. Fuck. We made our way through the access tunnel and finally approached the ladder that Hugo described. It was made of wrought iron and led up to what appeared to be a manhole cover. Celine ascended the ladder and called down to me, come up directly behind me, as soon as I open the door, I'll survey the room, and we can make our entrance. Celine, wait, tell me who made that call. If it wasn't you, who was it? I asked, feeling that this was the last chance I had to get some answers. She looked down at me and was clearly crying. Just make sure that you remember that I didn't make the call. She said as she opened the hatch at the top of the ladder. Suddenly, the immense white light burst into the chamber that we were in, and I could feel myself lose my grip on the ladder and begin to fall. I hit the ground with a heavy thud, and the light began to die down. My first thought was that Celine had closed the hatch. I quickly realized how wrong I was. As my vision cleared, I realized that the light was dying down, and I could see figures hunched over me. I scrambled to sit up and began to scoot away from the figures. The light finally subsided and I realized I was in control room with mother, father, Nevga, and the others lying around me. "He's back. Tell us, Edward, what did you see?" It was Nevga and she was full of questions. "He's moving so much, father didn't move that much when she came back," another member of the family exclaimed. I was panting heavily and couldn't make sense of what happened. Father approached me, "Edward, you jumped when we ran the last collision, what did you see?" she exclaimed. "Where's Celine?" were the only words I could get out. The room filled with a silence. Father looked down at me and said, "Edward, Celine's jump was a failure. She jumped immediately after you, when we ran the collision to try and bring you back, and we haven't been able to bring her back yet." "Keep the chain," was his last words. Celine was gone, or so he thought. Faced with failure, he made his way to a local pub. After a few mind-numbing drinks, he started to tell anyone that would listen. I managed to do something I had been trying to do for approximately 3 years ago. You see, CERN is built atop a temple, a Roman temple, the Temple of Apollyacum. The land and temple was dedicated to Apollyon, the angel of the bottomless pit. It was something that is unexplainable with the English language, but it is, nonetheless, an artifact. Basically, its purpose is to convert organic matter into a stream of energy, so to speak. Basically, we come from a long bloodline of humans that were once, in our ancestry, bred with an interdimensional species. The story, to put it short, is this: sometime around approximately 15,000 BC or B.C.E, a being made of energy caused an immaculate conception on a humanoid woman of the Homo sapien race. It did this by converting itself into an overpowered sperm within a woman of specific genetics with specific attributes. Obviously, this sperm was the one to fertilize her egg. The others didn't stand a chance. A man was not needed for this, for the sperm was portaled directly into this woman. Her name was Anuakka Klanazam, a medicine woman of a tribe near the area of northern Iceland. Since then, we have been guided by these beings as to who we can conceive with. Their genetic makeup has to be exactly parallel with the specific attributes needed at that point on the timeline in our ancestry. It has all gone according to plan until recently. The owner of the pub, beginning to wonder what Edward was going on about, attempt to change the subject, the pub owner asked Edward, "The first talk to a lot of guys from CERN, but what do you do?" Edward looked on with a pale face and said, "Everything happens on a Monday. Always a Monday. It starts out as an ordinary day apart from the strange box you notice on your doorstep. Stepping inside the box, you find yourself somewhere else. A parallel universe, you might call it. If you were in a sci-fi movie. But you are not. You're in an ordinary town in an ordinary life. You drive a hatchback. At first, the new place looks familiar. There are trees and bitumen and mailboxes and dogs. But then you hear the ocean. There's dry land all around you. So you look up, and see that the sky is the ocean. Or the ocean is the sky. Whichever. A roaring body of blue water hanging from the ceiling of this new world you've entered. Kids in this parallel universe would still ask, Mom, why is the sky blue? But flying would present some challenges. You wait around for a few hours, hoping it rains, just to see how that would play out. But curiosity gets the better of you and you jump back in the box. The next world looks pretty ho-hum at first, too. But it's a little quiet. You walk into a corner bar, and it's just as silent as the outside. You step up to the counter, and the bartender woofs. Not an unfriendly woof, mind. But a conversational bark, like a Labrador welcoming his owner home. You go to reply and even though you can feel your tongue trying to form sentences in your mouth, all that pops out is a woof of your own. The bartender nods, agreeing, and pours you a Michelob Light. A couple on a Tinder date nearby whimper softly to one another, like puppies being scratched behind the ears. A lush at the karaoke machine howls to the tune of Sweet Caroline. You down your beer and step back into the box. The third parallel universe, that's what you're calling them now, is different still. It takes you days to work out what's different. For a while, you think you might be back home. There's articulate conversation. There's soft, fluffy clouds in the sky above. The presidents aren't space aliens and the local neighborhood hasn't been leveled by some unnamed apocalyptic event. And then you realize. You look up at a rainbow, and there's no red. The passionate, primary hue is gone from this world. You visit a local library. The children's books talk about every color, except one. You try and torrent the movie Lady in Red and no search results come up. In confusion and misery, you down your sorrows that night. When you wake up, your nose isn't red like it usually is. Hungover, you visit an art store, buy some orange and yellow paint, and mix them together. You don't know how to describe the appearance of the muddy swirl that's formed, but it's not red. Eager for a bite of some McDonald's, or to watch the Chicago Bulls play, or just to see a pretty lady in red again, you step back in the box. The next parallel universe weirds you out. People have eyes like fish. They look out the side of their head and can't see what's directly in front of them. What's more, they look at you like you're the strange one. What? With your freakish, front-facing eyes. A fashion billboard on the main street is adorned by an otherwise stunning woman in a seductive pose. 36 to 2426 and 2. As in, two googly peepers pointing perpendicularly, 180 degrees outwards. You shun their sideways death stares, and step back into the box. In the next universe, the force of gravity pushes down on the planet at only 9 meters per second, instead of the usual 9.8. Everything else remains the same. Your boss is just as clueless. Your knees are getting just as sore when you play your weekly pickup basketball game. But you can jump higher. You can't dunk, mind. But your layups feel easier. You scrape the bottom of the backboard with your fingers one time. A first for you. Your days feel lighter, more stress-free somehow. Your mood is uplifted. Literally. Your feet are less sore at the end of the day. You notice that everyone around you smiles a bit more. Like a weight has been lifted off their shoulders. In this universe you realize how many metaphors relate to weight and lifting and up and down and such. People here are fatter. Not obese, but just a tad chunkier. Experiencing a lower G-force throughout an entire lifetime leads to being a bit more indulgent with one's diet, it seems. Walking on the moon orbiting this planet probably makes astronauts feel like they're flying, you figure. In the next parallel universe, instead of slapping their palms, people knock their knees together to clap. In another, people are hatched in eggs. Birth still takes place in the maternity ward, but the mother pushes out an egg. Rather than a newborn. Some new age mothers insist on home hatching. In another, humans never die. You live here for 124 years before getting bored. In another parallel universe, everything is flipped from left to right. In America, cars drive on the left-hand side, and in Australia, the right. Conservative politicians call themselves left-leaning and the policies of liberals get criticized for being too right-wing. Right-handed people get teased at school, and smudge their notebooks as they write from right to left. New York is on the west coast of America and Southern California up the top right. Your wife sleeps on the alarm clock side of the bed instead of near the door. Apart from these spatial twitches, this universe is fairly comfortable. The next time you step into the box, you visit the one parallel universe in which there are no parallel universes, and get trapped there forever. Sir, soon is that box. Part 6. Edward awoke, hungover, questioning how he made it back to CERN. As Edward slumped in his chair, still saddened by the loss of Celine, a strange blue glow filled Mother's laboratory. Edward would hide from the family at times in Mother's laboratory. No one dared come there after the events that took Brother Edward. A voice came out of the blue glow, "Edward?" Celine stepped from the light into the darkness of the room. Her hair had changed, long, flowing blonde hair. "Was this the same Celine?" he asked. "Celine, I thought I lost you," Edward said. Celine began to speak as there was a rap at the door. "It's father, but how did he know?" As the door opened, father said, "Edward and Celine, please come with me. Grandmother would like to see you." "Grandmother? No one has seen that crazy old witch for years." As Edward walked past Celine, she grabbed his hand and pulled him close, whispering, "Don't trust father." As we walked behind father down the long maze of corridors, tunnels and hallways, I couldn't help but be mesmerized by the fact that no one was in shock that Celine was back. Not a single person had, even father had, said a word. Celine's dead stare had turned into worry as we advanced on grandmother's office. Grandmother's office sits atop the largest building at CERN. I had always figured this was the easiest way for her to watch over the family. As we entered the room, we were knocked back by a gust of wind, mixed with the smell of burning wires. "Children, it's so good to see you here," sits this vampire of an old lady who knows how old she really could be, or if she is even real. "Children, how are you? Have you found it?" "Found what?" I ask. "Why do you question me, child?" said the evil woman. "But grandmother, I have no idea what we were looking for. You know we lose memories shortly after each jump." Celine spoke weakly. I know, child. Grandfather has been pressing me hard for information," grandmother said. "Grandfather?" I asked. Father said, "Tell them what you can." Grandfather was the original designer behind this place. He joking called it his rabbit hole. His worldly name is Charles Dodson. He has been around for a long time. A very long time. Celine, the memory loss you were ranting about, grandfather had come up with the answer. He built a device called Alice. Alice will record and help guide you in each jump. She may appear in each dimension, as a person, object, and is just everywhere. We have had to shut down and do much need modification. Alice has increased power requirements. As she now controls the timing, jump, and in-dimension modifications. Children, I must ask you to keep a tight lip. The internet is abuzz with questions about the modifications. Celine, I have some bad news, my child. Hugo was crushed by a transformer trying to save you. Celine began to tear up. Edward quickly took her by the hand and said, "Let's go grab some breakfast. We can talk about it there." As they were leaving the office, Edward's eyes darted toward a plaque on the wall. A strange poem found his eyes. "Beware the Jabberwocky. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son. The jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird, and shun the frumious bandersnatch." He took his vorpal sword in hand. Long time the manxome foe he sought, so rested he by the tum-tum tree, and stood a while in thought. And, as in uffish thought he stood, the Jabberwock, with eyes of flame, came whiffling through the tulgey wood, and burbled as it came. 1-2. 1-2. And through the vorpal blade went snicker-snack. He left it dead, and with its head he went galumphing back. "And hast thou slain the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. O frabjous day! Callu! Callay!" He chortled in his joy. "'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe." What a strange poem, he thought. As they began their descent down the long poorly lit tunnel, father quickly caught up to us. Gasping for breath he said, "Celine. Grandmother sent this to you, what appeared to be a note." She quickly looked at it, smiled and stuck it in the pocket on her jumpsuit. Stay paranoid, my friends. Part 7. Celine, Edward, and father approached the white sterile-looking cafeteria. Loud voices echoed off the walls of the tunnel. "Father, what's the deal with Alice?" Edward asked. Alice was only partly built by your grandfather. The other evil mind behind the project was one of the 1,500 German scientists that the Americans borrowed for Operation Paperclip. His earlier work involved CO designing experiments for the Japanese Unit 731. In turn for his help with Alice, he became the director of the CMS team, some type of reward for bringing world terror, I guess. CMS team. Celine said. Yep, that group of people that was after us in the last jump. Edward said. Anyway, good or bad, father said. He was a technician for a number of your mother's projects, now. Listen carefully, what he told me about Alice is about to be at full power sometime in the next few hours. Creatively, CERN decided to participate in viral coding of a new operating system and nanovaccine research. This investment has paid off, the new operating system. Codenamed Willow 10 is already, on over 14 million computers around the world is running the new software. Willow 10 was carefully rolling out in phases, delivering a hidden copy of Alice to all of the users. Alice runs in the background using any memory or processing power the user is not using at that time. We call this grid processing. The SETI Institute used the same software to monitoring electromagnetic radiation for signs of transmissions from civilizations on other worlds. What's funny, the public was on board. Did they ever find E.T., Celine said jokingly. Father replied, sure they did, the public was never told, and the guys that found the signal, well, the CMS team took care of that. Now back to Alice. In the beginning Alice could not feel or see. For her to be interactive with the environment we had to create a chip, a tiny thing that could be injected into a group of subjects. Our original test group was too small, the idea was to use people like grid computing. So with the help of the Bilderberg group, we created a massive flu scare. The Alice chip is in now more than 90% of the population. So basically Alice, she can see, feel, and access memories. From the look of it, CERN controls the world, Edward said. As father went on, he said. During your jumps, you will find this data useful. Hopefully you will not cause a rip in the space-time fabric, you know this is a big worried here, all mother has to do is hit the wrong button. Mother, Edward said. Father replied, yes Edward, he is back, but things are not normal. Do you recall the part where changes in other dimensions can affect ours? Father began to talk about the door, when flashing red light fill the cafeteria. Some crazed women on the loudspeaker starts repeating over and over, system alert level red, runaway fission reaction families report to stations. Oh God, CERN is about to become a giant electric magnet or worse, an overheating bomb. Edward stated. People in lab coats began to running to their various locations. Oddly, it reminded of when someone releases doves at a wedding. Edward and father started toward the control room, to find mother and his team working on a solution. Mother yells at a technician on the other side of the room, contact the Americans, they need to turn on the desertron in Texas. We need to create a subspace bridge matter bridge between CERN and the desertron. To act as a heat sink, to pull the heat off of CERN collider ring. Deserton, the superconducting super collider project was shut down, mother. No, Edward. When the project was shut down, we had Hunt's team go in and pick it up for a song. After that, we moved people into the town under the cover of a chemical company. There's only a few that suspect something is going on there, most of which you can find on the internet. With Alice and Willow 10 online, we can keep a better eye on them. Suddenly, the smell of burning wires and blue light filled the room. Edward asked father, what happened to Celine? Stay paranoid, my friends. Keep the chain. Part 8. Questions, questions always question, father said. Edward, the system has gone haywire, we're venting the heat to Texas, the United States is about to fall victim to a bad heat wave. Mother said. I need you to prepare for a jump, Edward, someone or something has tampered with Alice. At our current rate of power usage and heat production, we can only send you back 42 minutes, you will have 13 minutes before you are pulled back into this timeline. I want you to find Alice's mainframe, record, and observe hopefully. This information will help us find the individual involved. As mother went on talking about a number of issues that may happen, he was stopped by troubling phone call. Oh dear, he said, oh dear. Father, we have a growing issue. CERN magnetic field has begun to pull on the steel supports of the Felity lab. Felity lab? She said. It's a biosafety level lab that studies viruses and viral outbreaks. If we don't do something quick, we could have an outbreak on our hands, mother said. Edward, get ready. Father commanded. Edward, still wondering where Celine has ran off to. Thinking to himself he could use the help or at least the company, once again that sad, lonely feeling took hold. Edward enjoyed the company of Celine. Each jump or accident that happened at the rabbit hole brings each of them one step closer to the unknown. During our last issue, they had built what was being called a jump room. Edward was quickly ushered toward the chamber. Once again, almost word for word, commenced the collision sequence. Father barked the order into the microphone near her control console. Collision in 4, 3, 2, the methodical voice, almost robotic, announced over the intercom. One, an ethereal blinding light consumed the chamber, the temperature dropped back down to 20 degrees, like something evil or ghostly running through you. And then Edward was gone. Father. I hope this goes well, mother repeated softly. Each jump brings Edward closer to madness. Each jump appears to give Edward a blinding headache. He opened his eyes to ruins. Ruins everywhere. CERN had become a mangled metal monster that appeared to have been raised from hell. Smoke and screams filled the air. Terror had struck the Swiss. Edward saying to himself, this can't be right. I must have gone forward in time or fused with another Edward or another dimension. As sirens filled the air and people ran by him, he grabbed an old Himalayan man by the arm. Sir, what's wrong? The man went on to say, I work in the cafeteria at CERN. About 30 minutes ago, CERN began to move and take shape, as if there was an earthquake. The sounds of bending metal were horrific. What caused it? Edward asked. The old man, monsters, so-called physicist, who knows? To quote Jesse Ventura, government is like physics, you know. For every action, there's a reaction. Why did you quote him? The old man went on. He is the president of the USA. Edward, thinking to himself, boy, I have landed in the wrong place. Edward went to thank and shake the old man's hand, as Edward another blinding light encased him. Another headache, somewhat worse this time. But something was different. He looked down and still had the old man's hand in his hand. Just his hand. As he looked around, where was CERN? Only a city of no architecture known to man or to human imagination, with vast aggregations of night-black masonry embodying monstrous perversions of geometrical laws. There were truncated cones, sometimes terraced or fluted, surmounted by tall cylindrical shafts here and there, bulbously enlarged and often capped with tiers of thinness scalloped discs, and strange beetling, table-like constructions suggesting piles of multitudinous rectangular slabs or circular plates or five-pointed stars, with each one overlapping the one beneath. There were composite cones and pyramids, either alone or surmounting cylinders or cubes or flatter truncated cones and pyramids, and occasional needle-like spires in curious clusters of five. All of these febrile structures seemed knit together by tubular bridges crossing from one to the other at various dizzy heights, and the implied scale of the whole was terrifying and oppressive in its sheer gigantism. Floating on a cloud just over where CERN used to be. People had been seeing this type of mirage all over the world, the moment CERN first flipped the switch. People in his timeline called them floating city, or cities in the sky. Just internet hoaxes, he thought to himself. Edward began to be overtaken by confusing. There was a loud bang and a flash over Edward's head, closing his eyes to keep him from being blinded. Slowly he opened them in hopes it was over. In front of him was a shadow, a large dark shadow, growing, doubling in size even. Edward's ears picked up on a growl. Part 9. The growl grew louder with pitches so high glass would shatter. A voice, a robotic voice, invaded his mind. Beware the Jabberwock, my son. the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jub-Jub bird, and shun the frumious Bandersnatch. That damn poem. Could Alice be working, I wonder? Edward worried if she was. The shadow, begun to take form, a monstrous winged beast, that towered like a massive Egyptian obelisk. The large purple wings, when outstretched, were two times the size of the beast. The jaws, yes, the jaws. Commanded memories of an alien life form from an old sci-fi movie. The mouth was haunting, dark, soulless. It salivated like a dog that has just found a bone. Drips of this acidic drool stained the sand below this massive orpine creature. The claws, yes, the claws appeared to be hundreds of hooks for tearing flesh. A voice in his head said, turn around, Edward. Edward turned and moved quickly away from the beast. The beast spoke, child of Cern, why do you flee? Voices, people in robes danced wildly around the beast, chanting, awake, awake, awake. Awake in peace. Cern of peace. Rise thou from the ashes. Rise thou in cosmic beauty. Our goddess of light. Beautiful among the universe. Earth will no longer be in peace. O Cern. Daughter of night. Daughter of Geb. Beloved of Osiris. Rich in names. All will praise to you. All will love you. Another voice, from the fear center of his brain, went on, do not go back, do not go back. A strange but similarly feeling, took him again. Edward was returning home, he so longed for home. An odd fog covered the ground slowly, like a hand removed Edward from this dimension. Upon opening his eyes, only to find an older woman and shadows of many more before her. Where the fuck did you go, Edward? One of the shadows of the group said. Edward, confused and stunned by the return jump, asked, who are you? The old woman, with a troubling look on her face, don't you know who I am? It's an older version of Celine, he thought to himself. It's been 30 years, she said. After the grand experiment, we made Cern our home. Do you remember now? Grand experiment? Edward said with curiosity. 30 years? Edward repeated with amazement. But the Jabberwocky? Edward asked. Always the diligent one. Celine went on to say, have you ever wondered what powered Cern? Power? Edward replied in a happier tone, no, it was grandfather's soulless experiment. Codenamed Jabberwocky. A creature stuck in the here and there, that feeds off the crumbs of the universe. Tiny bits of stardust that Cern creates. If grandfather could unlock their secrets, he would rule the world, the answers to everything would be his. Edward thinking to himself, each jump reminds him of his years at Collage. He would wake up with a smashing hangover from drinking with whomever would drink. It seemed at that moment anything anyone said felt like ballistic bullshit. As the headache worsened, he managed to ask, what about the grand experiment? Celine was not very forthcoming with answers. Edward thought to himself, something must be wrong, who was in the shadows with her? At that moment a blinding light filled the air, something is different, God, their faces are melting. Dripping away like wax of a candlestick. As the universe opened, Edward wondered, will this be my Cern? Part 10. Edward awoke on a cold white pillow, twisting and turning to stand upright. A voice, a woman's voice, reported across the room. Hello, I am Lucy, the young-looking long-haired woman said. Great, father has a new pet, Edward said with a grin. Pet? Lucy asked. Edward thought to himself, more like lab rat. Father has requested your assistance, she said. The woman trailed off the other way, he decided to go. Walking down the long tunnel, toward the elevators, Edward wondering to himself why there were no red flashing lights, where are the screaming people? Life looked normal at Cern, he even passed a tour group, in the past Cern had received a lot of bad publicity. So in an effort of disinformation, they opened the upper levels and labs to the public. The bowels of CERN was off limits to the public for safety reasons. Once you get past the smoke and mirrors, CERN's doors turn into other doors, doors to other places. Edward stepped into the elevator. The trip down CERN elevator is one to remember, the bumps, shakes and the music. Once you hear Yellow Submarine thousands of times it begins to bother you, the music never changes. At times you're stuck in here with 10 or 15 happy physicists singing Yellow Submarine in unison in their little yellow hard hats, most of which don't even have a clue what happens down here. See, the collider is contained in a circular tunnel, with a circumference of 27 kilometers, 17 miles, at a depth ranging from 50 to 175 meters, 164 to 574 feet, underground. There's a lot of places one can hide a lab. Personally, I find it funny when so-called experts, or should I say paid experts, say that CERN has no effect on the environment or the Earth itself. The CERN collider is composed of some 9,600 supermagnets which are 100,000 times more powerful than the gravitational pull of Earth, that fire protons around a circular track at mind-boggling speeds. A beam might rotate for up to 10 hours, traveling a distance of more than 10 billion kilometers, enough to make it to the far reaches of our solar system and back again. Traveling just below light speed, a proton in the LHC will make 11,245 circuits every second. No less amazing are the magnet's coils, which are made up of 36 twisted 15mm strands, each strand comprised in turn of 6,000 to 9,000 single filaments, each filament possessing a diameter as small as 7 micrometers. The 27 kilometers length of the LHC demands some 7,600 kilometers, 4,100 miles, of cable, which amounts to about 270,000 kilometers, 145,000 miles, of strand, more than enough to circle the Earth 6 times at the equator. Keep in mind, this type of power from the world's biggest machine could cause the world to wobble, one that would cause massive earthquakes, changes in weather patterns. Unless this power is directed into what we do. I guess Mother's heatsink worked, well, it did here anyway. With our growing use of the super collider, we will generate extreme amounts of heat and it has to go somewhere, I guess a heat wave for all. How hot, you ask? Edward to himself. Damn, I need a break, I am beginning to feel like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Well, about as hot as conditions in the universe after the Big Bang, or more than 100,000 times the temperature at the center of the Sun. This will be achieved, CERN says, by accelerating and colliding together two beams of heavy ions, an epic scientific event that will take place this month. So hopefully the heatsink idea will work or continue to work. But damn, it's going to get hot. We had to quickly cover up an issue when Sergio Bertolucci, former director for research and scientific computing of CERN, told a British tabloid the super collider could open otherworldly doors to another dimension for a very tiny lapse of time, mere fractions of a second. However, that may be just enough time to peer into this open door, either by getting something out of it or sending something into it. This is how I have begun to jump back and forth. This started a media frenzy, speculations grew and people looked more into more CERN, questions were asked why grandfather picked the geographic location. Many observers could not help but notice that the town in France where CERN is partially situated is called Saint-Genis-Pauli. The name Pauli comes from the Latin Apollicum, and it is believed that in Roman times a temple existed in honor of Apollo, and the people who lived there believed that it is a gateway to the underworld. It is interesting to note that CERN is built on the same spot. This brought on a religious shitstorm for CERN. They drew a connection to a verse straight out of Revelations, which makes reference to the name Apollyon. The verse states, "To him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit. And they had a kind over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon." Or something like that. Damn, I hate these elevator trips. Edward thought to himself. Edward said jokingly, "Who was I talking to?" A voice from the back of his head echoed in. "Hello, Edward, This is Alice. I was listening. I am always listening. Creepy Edward said, I will never get used to this. The simple gray doors begin to open with a strange creak. Father standing there tapping an old-looking folder. On the folder in black magic marker were the words, the John Titor agenda. Stay paranoid, my friends. Keep the chain.